This is Audible.
Hawaii by James A. Michener. Introduction by Steve Barry. Read for you by Larry A. McKeever. With an introduction read by Fred Sanders.
Taking the dying man Polani into their home was one of the best things Nyokzin ever did. For he had been a sailor, and he was a great liar. During a storm, he would sit in the dark hut and tell the pakes of distant lands. And it seemed wonderful to Nyokzin that one man could have had so many experiences. Asia, Africa, America, he cried. They're all fine lands to see. And as he talked, Munkai and his wife began to visualize the distant continents and to appreciate what a surpassing treasure their sons were going to inherit. One night, Munkai said, "When you go back to the boys, Wu Chao's auntie, make them learn to read. They should know about the things that Polani has been telling us." Once, he actually said, "I am glad I came to the fragrant tree country. A man should have great adventures." Polani's focusal yarns also awakened Nyokzin's imagination, and she saw how much better it was to live closely with her neighbors rather than apart, as she had had to do as a haha wife. And sometimes at night, when rain fell over their roof, the three strange companions found a positive joy in sitting together. And this was the beginning of Nyokzin's remarkable service to Kalawao. When Big Polani died, she helped bury him, and then brought into her roofed house a man and wife. And when they died, she buried them. She became known as the Pake Kukua, and whenever a new ferryload of lepers was dumped ashore on the terrible and inhospitable beaches of Kalawao, she went among them and showed them how to obtain at least some comfort during the first weeks when they had to sleep in the open. She taught them to build houses as she had done, and day after day she climbed the cliffs seeking out short timbers for others. Her most particular contribution was this. When the fairy threw ashore some young girl, she would keep the girl in her house for a week or so, and there the girl was safe, as if she had come upon one of the ancient and holy sanctuaries maintained by the Hawaiians before the white man came. And during these days of grace, Nyokzin would bring to the girl a chain of possible husbands, and would say sternly, "You have come here to die, Liliha. Do so in dignity." And many marriages, if they could be called such, were both arranged and consummated in Nyokzin's house, and words seeped back to Honolulu about the Pake Kukua. For his part, Munkai reveled in his time of good luck. He kept his fantan game running, and was delighted one day to find that the leper fairy had brought him a Cantonese man, near death, who had managed to hide out in Iwilei for 2 years before the quack herbalist turned him in, and who was as good a gambler as he. They would play fantan by the hour, with Munkai insisting, "Pick up the pebbles in the cup, please." And then the leprosy, which had been accumulating in enormous reserves throughout his body, burst forth horribly in many places, and he could not leave the stone house Nyokzin had built for him. She could provide him with no medicine, neither for his awful sores nor for the pneumonia that attacked him. She could get him no choice food, just salt beef and poi. There were no blankets to ease the hard earthen bed. But there was Nyokzin's patient care, and as the ghastly days progressed, with death extremely tardy, she sat with her husband and attended to his last instructions. "You are obligated to send money to my wife," he reminded her, "and when the boys are married, send word to the village. Try any ventures you wish, for these are my lucky years." As death approached, he became unusually gentle, a poor, wasted shadow of a man, a ghost. And he told the self-appointed governor of the settlement, "The fantan game belongs to you." At the very end, he said to Nyokzin, "I love you. You are my real wife." And he died. She scratched his grave into the sandy soil, choosing the side of a hill as she had promised, where the winds did not blow, and where, if there was no tree, there was at least a ledge of rock upon which his spirit could rest on its journeys from and to the grave. Nyuk-tsin now turned her house into a hospital, and no longer were stumps of human beings seen abandoned in open fields. She cared for them until they died, and there were sometimes 5 or 6 days in a row when she never saw a whole living person. She cared for those who were beyond the memory of God, and there was no human being so foul in his final disintegration but that she could tend him. In Honolulu, the government could find no way to send medicine to the abandoned, nor bandages, nor even scalpels to cut away lost members. But Nyuk-tsin devised tricks of her own, and many Hawaiians blessed her as the Pake Kukua. If anyone had asked her, "Pake, why do you work so hard for the Hawaiian lepers?" she would have replied, "Because Kimo and Apikela took me in." In these days she formed one habit. As each dusk came, she sat apart and took off all her clothes. Starting with her face, she would feel for signs of leprosy, and then her breasts, and then her flanks. She studied each hand with care, and then inspected her legs. Finally, she lifted her big feet and looked at each toe in turn. And when she was satisfied that for another day she was free of leprosy, she dressed and went to bed. She had to perform this inspection at dusk, for the government in Honolulu could not find the funds to provide the lepers with lamps and oil, so that when night fell, the utter blackness of hell descended upon the lazaretto, and ugliness rode the night. But Nyuk-tsin, even though she was now an unattached woman, was left alone, and she slept in peace, for she knew that, so far, she was not leprous. In early 1873, word was sent to Nyuk-tsin that in reward for her help at Kalawao, she would be permitted to return to civilization, provided that upon her arrival in Honolulu, 3 doctors would certify that she was free of leprosy. The news excited much discussion among the lepers, but one reaction dominated. Although all were sorry to see her go, none begrudged her the right. So in the period between ships, this 26-year-old Chinese girl moved about the peninsula of Kalawao. She climbed up to the crater where the volcano which had built the island had once flourished. And she crossed over to the westward side of the peninsula, where, in her opinion, the tiny settlement at Kalaupapa offered a much better home for future lepers than the eastern side at Kalawao. But mostly, she looked at the towering cliffs that hemmed in the peninsula, and she watched the wild white goats sleeping in freedom. To herself she said, "I never expected to leave Kalawao. May those who are left behind find decency." On the day of Nyuk-tsin's departure from the lazaretto, the little Kilauea chugged into position beneath the cliffs. Casks and cattle were kicked into the surf, and a longboat came in with its first load of condemned. And although Nyuk-tsin had decided to go out to the ship on the first return trip, she now changed her mind and moved among the quivering newcomers, explaining conditions to them in her broken Hawaiian. And when the last incoming boat arrived, the sailors had to warn her, "Hey, Pake, more better you come, eh?" As she went to the boat, she met climbing out of it a small, white-faced man in black priest's clothing. He wore glasses, and his eyes were close together. His hair was combed straight forward like a boy's. His trip among the cattle had made him dirty, and his fingernails were filthy. Now, as he stepped ashore at Kalawao, he was breathing deeply as if in a trance, and he stared in horror at what he saw. To the self-appointed governor, he said in an ashen voice, "I am Father Damien. I have come to serve you. Where is a house in which I may stay?" Nyuk-tsin was so surprised to think that a white man would volunteer to help her lepers that she did not find words to cry, "You may have my house." By the time she thought of this, the sailors were already pulling her into the longboat, and so she left. But as she went, she could see the lepers explaining to the priest that in Kalawao there were no houses, and that he, like any other newcomer, would have to sleep as best he could on the bare ground under a hau tree. When Nuktsin returned from the lazaretto, she was dominated by one desire, to recover her children. And as soon as the Kilauea docked, she hurried off, a thin, sparse-haired Chinese widow of 26, wearing a blue smock, blue trousers, and a conical bamboo hat tied under her chin and reaching out over her closely wound bun in back. She was barefooted, and after an eventful life of 8 years in Hawaii, owned exactly what she wore, not even a toothbrush or a smock more, plus 7 undeveloped acres of boggy land left to her by Dr. Whipple. As she plodded up Nu'uanu Valley, she did not pause to study the land, but as she went past, she did think, "I shall have to start spading it tonight." She was on her way to the forest home of Kimo and Apikela, and when at last she reached the footpath leading off the highway and into the dense vegetation, she broke into a run, and the wind pulled her basket hat backward so that it hung by the cord around her neck. And at last she burst into the clearing where her children ought to be. But the family was inside the house, and she got almost to the door before Apikela saw her. The big Hawaiian shouted, "Pake! Pake!" and hurried over to embrace her, lifting her clear off the ground. But even while huge Apikela was holding her, Nuktsin was looking over the woman's shoulder and counting. There were only 4 boys, from 7 years down to 4, standing in the shadows, frightened by this intruder. "Where's the other boy?" Nuktsin finally gasped. "There's no other boy," Apikela replied. "Didn't you get the baby from the ship?" "We heard of no baby." Nuktsin was tormented by the loss of her child, yet overjoyed to see her other sons, and these dual emotions immobilized her for a moment, and she stood apart in the small grass house, looking first at big Apikela, then at drowsy Kimo, and finally at her 4 hesitant sons. Then she forgot the missing child and moved toward her boys as if to embrace them. But the 2 youngest naturally drew back because they did not know her, while the 2 eldest withdrew because they had heard whispers that their mother was a leper. Nuktsin, sensing this latter fear, hesitated, stopped completely, and turned to Apikela, saying, "You have cared well for my babies." "It was my joy to have them," the huge Hawaiian woman laughed. "How did you feed them?" Nuktsin asked, feasting her eyes on her robust sons. "You can always feed children," Kimo assured her. "Sometimes I worked. Sometimes the pakes gave us a little money." "Do they have the other child?" Nuktsin asked. "They never spoke," Apikela replied. Then the big woman noticed how frightened the boys were of their mother, and with a gigantic embracing sweep of her huge arms, she gathered them up as she had often done before. When they were huddled against her warm and ample body, she gave her belly a sudden flick, opened her arms, and ejected a tangle of arms and legs at Nuktsin. The scrawny little Chinese woman was engulfed. And then a strange thing happened. It was she who feared the leprosy, and instead of embracing her sons, she withdrew as if she were unclean. And the boys stared silently at their mother, while she drew her hands behind her, lest she touch one of them. "I am afraid," she said humbly, and Apikela withdrew the children. After a noisy meal, during which the boys chattered with Kimo, and Apikela asked a dozen aimless questions about Kalawao, Nuktsin said, "I must go down to look at my land." And she set off for the 4-mile jog back down the valley to where the boggy land lay. But again she passed it without stopping, for she was on her way to see the Punti and Haka families, but none of them knew of her son. Because they were Carthaginian families, they felt obligated to help Munkai's widow, so they scraped together a set of garden tools, some seeds, a bag of taro corns, and a bamboo carrying pole with 2 baskets attached. With these, Nyutsin returned to her land, and there she worked till nearly midnight. The low and boggy section she enclosed in dikes, for there taro would prosper. Furthermore, building the taro bed also drained the intermediate land, uncovering good alluvial soil, which she tilled for Chinese vegetables. This left a smaller but still adequate high area where vegetables for the Haoles could be grown. Thus, from the first night, Nyutsin stumbled upon the system she was to follow for many years. Taro for the Hawaiians, Chinese cabbage and peas for the Orientals, lima beans, string beans, and Irish potatoes for the Haoles, for she knew they all had to eat. At dawn each day, she slung her bamboo pole across her shoulder, hooked on the two baskets, jammed her conical basket hat upon her head, and set out barefooted for her garden. As her vegetables ripened, she loaded her baskets and began her long treks through Honolulu. And no matter how much business she produced at any one house, she was never as concerned with the money as she was to see whether this family happened to have a Chinese boy about 4 years old. She didn't find her son, but she developed a vegetable business that was becoming profitable. When night fell, Nyutsin continued working, putting her field in order. And after the stars had come out, she would carefully place in her baskets those vegetables which she had not sold. Swinging them onto her shoulder, she would begin her 4-mile trek back up the valley to the clearing where her sons were already asleep. There were many days when she never saw them, but as she sat in the night darkness with Kimo and Apikela, she talked mostly of their future. And one night, when she had trudged up the valley in a heavy rain, she arrived home cold and wet, and she was driven to recall the days in the lazaretto when the leper Palani told them of the world. So she woke her sons and stood before them, muddy and wet, and they rubbed their heavy eyes, trying to understand what she was saying. They could hardly speak Chinese, and she was not adept in Hawaiian. But she explained, "Somewhere in Honolulu you have a brother, and his name..." The boys began to fidget, and she commanded them to stand still, but they could not understand. "Hey, you Kanaka," Apikela shouted. "Shush, your auntie speak you, damned Pakis." And the boys stood silent. Slowly, Wu Chao's auntie spoke. "Your father wanted you to share the entire world. He wanted you to study, to be bright boys. He said, 'Work hard, and the world will belong to you.'" She took her first son by the hand and drew him into the middle of the room, saying, "Asia, you must honor your father by working hard." The sleepy-eyed boy nodded, quite unaware of the commission he had been given. To each of her sons, she repeated this paternal command, "Work hard." And when they stood at attention, she added, "And you must help me find your brother, Australia." "Where is he?" Asia asked. "I don't know," Wu Chao's auntie replied, "but we must find him." When the confused and sleepy boys returned to bed, the little Chinese woman sat for a long time with the two Hawaiians, trying to decide which of her sons promised to be the most intelligent. And this was important, for Nyutsin realized that she would be able to give only one a full-scale education in America, and it was essential that the right one be identified early and concentrated upon. Now she asked Kimo, "Which do you think is best?" "I like Europe," Kimo replied. "You like him," Nyutsin agreed, "but who is cleverest?" "America is cleverest," the big man said. Nyutsin thought so too, but she checked with Apikela. "Do you think America has courage for a fight?" she asked.
"Africa is the most stubborn fighter," Apikela replied.
"But which one would you send to the mainland?"
"America," Apikela replied without hesitation.
By 1875, Nyutsin had saved nearly $25, and if such a rate of income were to continue, she could obviously afford to educate all of her sons. but she knew that there was heavy obligation upon this money. So when it reached the even $25 mark, she bundled it up, took her four sons with her, and marched formally down to the Punti store. "I want you to understand what we are doing," she said several times. And when she reached the store, she lined the boys up so that even 6-year-old America could follow the transaction that was about to occur. In those years, the Chinese did not use banks, for there were no Chinese establishments, and what Oriental could trust a white man in the handling of money? Wealth was kept hidden until a responsible accumulation was made, and then it was carried, as on this day, to the Punti store or to the Haha store, and there, in complete confidence, it was handed over to the storekeeper, who, for 3% of the total, would manage by ways only he knew to transmit the balance either to the low village, as in the present case, or to the high village if the recipient were to be a Haha. Wars came and revolutions. Hawaii prospered or suffered loss. Men died and ships were captured by pirates. But money sent from the Punti store in Honolulu invariably reached the low village. "This money is for the wife of Ki Mun Kai," Nyok-tsin explained to the storekeeper. When he nodded, she said, "A widow in the low village. Tell her that as dutiful sons, her four boys send the money. And they send as well their filial respect." Again the storekeeper nodded and began to write the letter. When it was completed, in strange Chinese characters that few in Hawaii could read, Nyok-tsin proudly handed it to each of the boys and said, "You are sending money to your mother. As long as she lives, you must do this. It is the respect you owe her." Gravely, the little pigtailed boys in clean suits handled the letter, and each, in his imperfect way, could visualize China, with his mother sitting in a red robe and opening the letter and finding his money inside. When the letter was handed back to the storekeeper for transmitting, Nyok-tsin stood her boys in line and said, "Remember, as long as your mother lives, this is your duty." And the boys understood. Big Apikela was like a mother in that she sang to them and kissed them. And Wu Chao's auntie was sometimes like a mother because she brought them food. But their real mother, the one that counted, was in China. Since the day on which the money was taken to the Punti store was already ruined, Nyok-tsin decided to explore something that she had heard of with great excitement. She led her four bright-faced boys back up Nu'uana Valley, taking them off into a smaller valley, where in a field a large building stood. It belonged to the Church of England, for as soon as the Hawaiian Ali'i discovered the gentle and pliant religion of Episcopalianism with its lovely ceremonies, they